Welcome to the Bulletin History Podcast, a quarterly presentation of the Public and Congressional Affairs Office of the U.S. Army Joint Munitions Command. JMC's mission is to provide conventional munitions for all U.S. military services. We currently manage 17 arsenals, depots, and ammunition plants around the country. But over the history of the Army, hundreds of installations have contributed to this mission. The goal of the Bulletin History Podcast is to tell the stories of our installations and the communities supporting them. We're not sure we can cover them all, but let's try. Please welcome your host, Dr. Paul Thomas Ferguson.
Thank you, Mark, for that introduction. And welcome, everyone, to Episode 4 of the Bulletin History Podcast. For this episode, we travel to West Central Missouri, home to the City of Independence and Lake City Army Ammunition Plant. Lake City was one of many Army installations established to produce materiel in support of U.S. warfighters and allies during World War II. Established as Lake City Arsenal in 1940, it began production in 1941 under the management of the Remington Arms Company, which would act as the operating contractor for more than 40 years. Apart from a five-year period after World War II, Lake City has remained in continuous operation ever since. Lake City Arsenal was the first of 12 Army installations established in 1940 to produce, test, and pack small arms ammunition, continuing this mission through the war. Construction of the first permanent building began in December 1940. At the groundbreaking ceremony, Missouri Senator Harry S. Truman was in attendance. At that time, he declared, "The faster we can get the job done, the more likely we are to stay at peace." The construction workforce peaked at more than 6,000 workers in July 1941, but the work continued for months after that, even when production began in September. By the time the installation was formally dedicated in October 1941, Lake City had 219 buildings. It would ship its first railcars of ammunition in November, 2 months ahead of schedule. Then in December, the attack on Pearl Harbor ended all hopes of peace. During World War II, Lake City produced approximately 5.7 billion rounds of ammunition, with the help of a workforce that rose to as high as 21,000 employees working around the clock. Those same workers supported the war effort in other ways, purchasing more than $1.2 million worth of war bonds. During its standby period from 1945 to 1950, Lake City fulfilled a peacetime, non-production mission, which included maintenance and rehabilitation of equipment, tools, and raw materials, along with land and facilities management in anticipation of future needs. In December 1950, Lake City was reactivated to provide ammunition for the Korean War. From a handful of employees during the interwar period, the workforce climbed to more than 11,000 in 1951. In 1952, the Atchison Cave Storage Facility was assigned to Lake City, providing an extensive, climate-controlled underground storage area. Lake City would manage Atchison Cave until 1963, when the storage area was reassigned to the Defense Industrial Plant Equipment Center under the Defense Supply Agency. But I'll have more to say about the Atchison Caves in a future episode. In 1955, as Lake City Ordnance Plant, the installation acquired the mission of inspecting and testing small arms equipment stores, which was later limited to 20mm through 30mm ammunition and gauges. By 1956, the plant was also manufacturing 20mm ammunition and M505 fuses. By the early 1960s, however, employment at the installation had dwindled to 1,500 people. The installation was redesignated Lake City Army Ammunition Plant in July 1963, and soon became equipped to mass-produce, test, and pack ammunition ranging from 5.56 mm to 30 mm, as well as explosives and pyrotechnics. As action expanded in Vietnam, Lake City once more ramped up production. By 1966, employment stood at 10,000, with the workforce ultimately producing 14.4 billion cartridges in support of the conflict. Employment in the 1970s peaked at 1,800 workers, and by the time Remington Arms turned over management to the Olin Corporation in 1985, Lake City had 2,800 employees. Several contractors have managed operations since that time. Today, Lake City Army Ammunition Plant consists of 375 buildings, 80 magazines, 25 warehouses, and 14 igloos on nearly 4,000 acres of land. The plant continues to test, demilitarize, and dispose of ammunition and explosives, while maintaining manufacturing capabilities to produce cartridges, primers, pyrotechnics, and several types of small-caliber ammunition. In the first two decades of the 21st century, the plant produced nearly 20 billion rounds of ammunition for the U.S. military. Though it is a federal installation, Lake City Army Ammunition Plant sits on the far eastern portion of the city of Independence, Missouri, within city limits. This town might not be on your radar as a place of significance yet, but it has been prominent enough through history to make me wonder if Independence, as suggested in the title of this episode, is one of the most important small towns in America. I'll let you judge for yourselves. Located east of Kansas City, the land that became Independence was occupied by the Missouri and Osage tribes before the first Spanish and French trappers stumbled upon the area. The site became a part of United States history in 1803, when it was transferred from French to American control through the Louisiana Purchase. To get an idea of what he had just acquired, President Thomas Jefferson sent explorers into the region to map out the territory. The first stage of this survey, which lasted from 1804 to 1806, became known as the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Departing from St. Charles in southeast Missouri on May 21, 1804, Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, and 40 others followed the course of the Missouri River upstream into the west. According to their journals, Lewis and Clark reached the Independence area in early June, where they stopped to harvest plums, raspberries, and apples. As early as 1821, pioneers moved through the area on their way west. As the site was at the westernmost spot where steamboats could safely travel on the Missouri River, it became a critical launching point for travelers on what would become the Oregon Trail. This led traders to settle in the area to make their fortunes outfitting pioneers for the journey overland. The population quickly grew, leading to the formal founding of the town in March 1827, naming it for the Declaration of Independence. In 1831, the city became an unlikely religious center when Latter-day Saint founder and prophet Joseph Smith declared independence to be the New Jerusalem and the center of Zion. In response, Mormon pioneers started emigrating to Independence and purchased a key plot of 63 acres there in December 1831. This became known as the Temple Lot, and was meant to become the center of the Latter-day Saint community in the world, but it didn't work out that way. As LDS members moved into the area, established residents grew increasingly concerned about their new neighbors. As happened wherever LDS communities moved, the Mormons quickly came to dominate the community, founding the area's first newspaper, forming their own schools, and starting competing businesses. Non-Mormons neither understood nor trusted this new religious group and feared that the rising number of LDS settlers would seize political dominance in the region. Tensions rose through July 1833, when established locals forcibly expelled the Mormons from Jackson County under threat of death and destroyed the property that was left behind. In response, Joseph Smith formed a paramilitary group to fight back in Missouri, but this effort failed, forcing most LDS followers to return to their previous homes in Ohio. Smith attempted to return to Missouri in 1838, leading even more immigrants than had come before, but they had given up on independence by then, in favor of settling in north-central Missouri. At this time, Smith formally adopted the name that the church has held ever since, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. LDS members found that they were not welcomed in central Missouri any more than they had been in Independence 5 years before. Clashes soon erupted as vigilantes and state militia each pushed back against Mormon settlement. The tension came to a head in October 1838 when Governor Lilburn Boggs issued Missouri Executive Order 44, which called for the expulsion or extermination of all Mormons. With the government aligned against them, Smith and his followers fled the state for Nauvoo, Illinois. After several years building a community in Nauvoo, similar tensions erupted with non-Mormon residents of Illinois, who feared the growing political power of the LDS community. This led to armed clashes between residents of Nauvoo and their neighbors, and the murder of Joseph Smith in 1844, and in 1847, the migration of the community to Salt Lake City under the leadership of Brigham Young. Executive Order 44 removed the perceived Mormon threat from Missouri and prevented mass migration of LDS settlers to the state in subsequent decades. In fact, the order technically remained the law of Missouri until it was declared unconstitutional in 1976. Returning to the history of independence, the town boomed in the 1830s and 1840s, sparked largely by the growing industry of outfitting pioneers for the journey west. Explorers had started clearing the Oregon Trail as early as 1811, and the first wagon train traveling that route left from Independence in 1836. The city quickly became a critical starting point for the Oregon and California trails. As a result, Independence would earn the nickname Queen City of Trails. Between 1846 and 1869, approximately 400,000 pioneers traveled this route, especially after the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill, California, in January 1848. Among those traveling west to seek their fortunes were members of the infamous Donner Party. Originating in Springfield, Illinois, the Donner Party, also called the Donner-Reed Party, left Independence in the spring of 1846, bound for California and the Oregon Territory. The small party occupied the last 9 wagons of a train of 500 teams striking out from Independence that year. A week into the journey, the Donner Party joined up with the 50-wagon Russell Party, the first of many stragglers the group would encounter along the way. The journey along the Oregon Trail usually should have taken 4 to 6 months, depending on weather. However, James Reed, head of the Reed family, advocated for a newly discovered route through the Wasatch Mountains, which bypassed the established northern route in favor of the Hastings Cutoff, which passed south of the Great Salt Lake before hooking up with the California Trail in Nevada. Scouts traveling ahead warned the party that the path through the Wasatch Range was difficult, but the warnings were ignored, and the party charged on. In the plains, they had managed approximately 15 miles per day. In the Wasatch Mountains, they only traveled 1.5 miles per day. They did not reach the west side of this first range of mountains, and finally catch their first glimpse of the Great Salt Lake until August 20th, well behind schedule. And it took another 2 weeks just to descend into the desert lands below. By this time, the Donner Party numbered 87 people. Finding little fresh water in the desert when they descended, the party opted to continue west in search of relief. What they had been told would be a 2-day journey across the desert to a natural spring took 6 days. By that time, they had been out of water for days, forcing them to leave many wagons, oxen, and horses behind. They spent several days recuperating at the springs in the center of the desert, during which time they recovered as many wagons as animals as they could. 40 miles of desert still lay ahead, but the party collected enough water to cross it without difficulty. On September 26th, they linked back up with the California Trail at the Humboldt River. Their difficulties in Utah had caused tension, which led to infighting among the pioneers. A few days after reaching the Humboldt River, James Reed, for example, was banished from the party altogether and sent into the mountains alone. In several other cases, fights broke out. Some families stopped talking to each other altogether. By the time the party reached the foot of the Rockies, it was October 20th. Scouts indicated that the passes should remain free of snow until mid-November, leaving a short window to cross the mountain. In turn, each family made the decision to continue on, a result of growing tired of the other families in the wagon train as they waited around. The Breen family left first, followed by the Kessebergs, the Reeds, the Graves, and the Murphys. Bringing up the rear was the Donner family. As the drawn-out wagon train climbed the mountains, the snow started to fall almost immediately. By the time they reached the east end of the pass, it was blocked. The party had no choice but to make winter camp at a place called Truckee Lake. An 8-day snowstorm began on November 4th. By this time, the party was low on food and the livestock began to die, prompting families to barter with each other for the right to use the carcasses as food. Small groups attempted to cross the pass, but failed, and returned to camp only to face another week-long blizzard. The livestock ran out, forcing the settlers to eat ox hide and make soup by boiling ox and horse bones. In December, a party of 17 left to attempt to cross the pass, but 8 of them died along the way. The rest of the party turned in desperation to those dead comrades, whom they ate. 2 of the remaining travelers, fearing for their lives, struck off on their own, reducing the party to 7 men. This group soon caught up with the 2 defectors, however, killed them, and butchered them for food. Only a few days later, the survivors reached a camp of Native Americans who nursed the settlers back to health. Their journey from Truckee Lake to the Native American camp had taken 33 days. In the meantime, James Reed had actually made it to California, where he organized a series of rescue missions to relieve those camped at Truckee Lake. A 7-man team crossed what became known as Donner Pass on February 18th and reached the camp to find that 13 more had died. 23 survivors left with the rescue party, although 3 of them would die on the journey. A second rescue party arrived at the camp on March 1st. This party rescued 17 from Truckee Lake, 14 of whom were children. 3 of them died on the way. The third rescue party arrived on March 14th, only to learn that several children had died over the past 2 weeks and been eaten. The rescue party secured the remaining 5 children, leaving a few suspiciously nourished men behind. Of the 87 members of the Donner Party, only 48 survived. The Reed and Breen families arrived intact, but all of the surviving Donner and Graves children were orphaned. The Truckee Lake camp became a tourist attraction as early as 1854. A monument was erected on the site in 1918, and in 1927, California established Donner Memorial State Park. The site became a state historical landmark in 1934 and a national landmark in 1963. That's already quite a lot of history launching from Independence, Missouri, but there's more where that came from. For example, during the Civil War, the town played host to 2 battles. In the summer of 1862, a band of 344 Union soldiers was stationed at Independence under the command of Lieutenant Colonel James T. Buell. On the evening of August 10th, Buell was warned that a band of Confederate soldiers was converging on the site, but he ignored this warning. Before dawn, on August 11th, a party of 750 Confederate soldiers under Colonel John T. Hughes attacked the site, catching the Federal soldiers by surprise. Buell surrendered, although 150 of his men were quickly paroled. The Confederacy had technically won the day, but also lost 10 officers in the process, including Colonel Hughes. As a result, Confederate forces were unable to take advantage of their victory. Meanwhile, on the Federal side, Buell was court-martialed for his failure to hold Independence, and was quickly mustered out of the army. On October 22, 1864, the Second Battle of Independence put the city at the center of events again. Confederate Major General Sterling Price had entered Missouri in September with more than 12,000 cavalry to raid throughout the state and raise sympathetic volunteers. Price fought his way to the outskirts of St. Louis by the 1st of October, then turned west to follow the course of the Missouri River. Opposing Price in Missouri were 10,000 men under Major General William Rosecrans, but they were scattered throughout the state. The two sides finally met at Independence on October 22nd, each with approximately 7,000 men on hand. Price led the Confederates, while the Federals were under the command of Major General Alfred Pleasonton. Over the course of the day, the Union forces drove Price's men through Independence, ultimately breaking their defenses at the Temple Lot. Price retreated, only to face defeat at the Battle of Westport the following day. Price withdrew from the state altogether by early November, with only 3,500 men remaining of the 12,000 he had once commanded. Finally, no discussion of Independence, Missouri would be complete without talking about Harry S. Truman. Truman's family moved to Independence in 1890 when he was 6 years old. Thanks to his father's connections in the Democratic Party, young Harry worked as a page for the Democratic National Convention when it came to Kansas City in 1900. Truman attended college but never finished, later making him the only president since William McKinley without a college degree. Instead, Truman worked several jobs as a young man looking to make his way in the world. These included stints as a mail handler for the Kansas City Star, timekeeper for the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, bank clerk, and farmer. He joined the Missouri National Guard in 1911 and served in the 2nd Missouri Field Artillery Regiment and other units in World War I as part of the American Expeditionary Force in France. In 1919, following the war, Truman married Bess Wallace. In 1922, he formally entered politics, winning election as county court judge for Jackson County's Eastern District with the help of Tom Pendergast, famous boss of the Kansas City Democratic machine. He would serve in this position from 1923 to 1925 and 1927 to 1935. In 1934, Pendergast backed Truman for U.S. Senator after his first four choices declined the offer. Pendergast's support ushered Truman to victory, but also saddled the new senator with a reputation for simply doing his mentor's bidding. Pendergast went to prison for tax evasion in 1939. As a result, Truman had to fight for re-election with a damaged reputation and a lack of Pendergast support. He won the primary by just 8,000 votes, and the general election by only 2 percentage points. In 1940, Truman became chairman of the Subcommittee on War Mobilization and launched an investigation into waste and war profiteering. The committee ultimately saved the government $15 billion, which would be at least $260 billion today. This earned Truman a positive national reputation that helped earn him a spot on the successful presidential ticket of 1944 as Franklin Roosevelt's vice president. Truman's time as vice president was brief, as Roosevelt died on April 12, 1945, just 82 days into this term. Truman assumed the presidency, ushering the U.S. through the final stages of World War II, which included the decision to use the atomic bomb to force the surrender of Japan. Truman was re-elected in 1948, so served the majority of two terms, during which time he faced the Soviet Union in the beginning of the Cold War, the eruption of the Korean War, McCarthyism, and his decision to recognize the State of Israel. After his presidency, Truman returned to Independence to live with Bess and her mother in the Wallace family home. He remained active in the community and in support of political candidates he favored. At the same time, he worked to raise private funds for his presidential library. In 1957, he successfully lobbied Congress to provide future funds for the management of presidential papers. Today, the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library stands in Independence as a monument to its hometown president, as does the Harry S. Truman National Historic Site, which is centered on his home. When Truman died in December 1972 at the age of 88, his widow chose to have a small ceremony instead of a state funeral. Even so, Independence commemorated the life of the former president with a community parade. The equipment needed for visiting military personnel who participated in this event, including sleeping cots and a mobile kitchen, were provided by Lake City Army Ammunition Plant. Before we finish, a final word about a few other landmarks in Independence, Missouri. Today, much of the Temple Lot is occupied by buildings, some religious and some non-religious in nature. There you will find the United Nations Peace Plaza and the Six Nations Tree of Peace. You'll also find the Truman Railroad Depot and the Auditorium of the Community of Christ. But what may be surprising is what you won't find. Because even though the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints purchased the temple lot nearly 2 centuries ago and maintains a visitor center and church on the site, there is nothing but empty green space occupying the corner where an LDS temple has never been built.
The Bulletin History Podcast is a quarterly presentation of the Public and Congressional Affairs Office of the U.S. Army Joint Munitions Command. Research, writing, and presentation by Dr. Paul Thomas Ferguson. Announcer, Mark Kane. Thank you for listening. We hope you join us for our next episode. Until then, we're history.